equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettenayer, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. I've got a blog on a similar theme. It's at the Vermont Commons website. It's called Relocalizing Vermont. Go to vtcommons.org. There are a lot of bloggers there. Look for the posts that begin Relocalizing Vermont. Those are mine. Also, the audio from this show is posted usually by the end of the next day at equaltimeradio.com. That's equaltimeradio.com. Got a great show coming up for you today. We're going to talk about a subject that we've taken up a lot of times in the past, but this time from more of an economics perspective. The subject is the peak and the decline of world oil production. And our main guest today is Jeff Rubin. He was senior economist at an investment banking firm, CIBC World Markets, for nearly 20 years. And he's the author of a new book, a very good book, called Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, Oil and the End of Globalization. So does peak oil mean that when the economy starts to turn around, oil prices will skyrocket and imports will become much more expensive? If so, is that the death knell for the global economy and the signal to revitalize local economies? We'll hear Rubin's take on these and other questions. And then in the last half of the show, we'll get a Vermont perspective from Sam Matthews. She is the vice president, the executive vice president of Central Vermont Economic Development Corporation. So it's a small world. I think we have Jeff Rubin on the line. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Welcome. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us all the way out from your hotel in Seattle, I understand it.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's a small world is a common saying, and I remember Charles Schulz tackling this theme when I was a kid in the Peanuts cartoons. I think Lucy was explaining to Linus that the world is getting smaller because so many people are walking around on it and it's just eroding away. There's less of it. She had a lot of off-the-wall explanations of things that grown-ups say. And I think Charlie Brown probably set Linus on the right path, explaining that, well, really, jet planes and other ways of traveling quickly made the world seem a whole lot smaller. But, Jeff Rubin, when you say our world is about to get a whole lot smaller, you mean something else. What do you mean by this?
Well, first of all, I mean your world's about to get a whole lot smaller because the world's going to get a whole lot bigger. The distance between places is going to seem far greater than it ever was when we have to contend with triple-digit oil prices, because no matter whether we're taking a boat, an airplane, whether we're moving stuff by truck or we're moving stuff by rail, all of those modes of transport depend on one thing, burning bunker fuel or jet fuel or gasoline, and they all come from crude. And I think what we're going to find in the world of triple-digit oil prices, which we've already had a brief glimpse of, but which is our future, is that distance costs money. And that's going to mean that not only are we not going to be able to go to trekking in Chiang Mai or bicycling in Burgundy, but maybe more importantly, as far as the world economy, the whole model of globalization, by that I mean to produce something at one end of the world and to sell it at the other end of the world, is simply not going to work.
I was intrigued to see last summer that you were already showing how the triple-digit oil prices that we experienced then were affecting the balance of trade between China and the U.S. and for things like steel.
Exactly. You know, there's only an hour and a half labor time embodied in producing a ton of steel. And when you consider what China has to do to send America steel, it's staggering on the transport cost side. First, they have to ship iron ore from Brazil all across the Pacific Ocean, turn it into steel, which in and of itself is a very energy-intensive process, and then ship it back. Well, you know, at triple-digit oil prices, that added on about $90 to the cost of a ton of hot-rolled steel, which was then about $600. And that extra transport cost all of a sudden made Chinese steel uncompetitive in the U.S. market. Chinese steel exports were dropped about 20%, while all of a sudden U.S. production was up double digit. This is, of course, before the recession hit. Now, that's steel. I mean, consider food. Steel doesn't have to be refrigerated as it crosses an ocean. Last year, China exported $6 billion worth of food, everything from bok chow to frozen chicken wings across the Pacific. Guess what that refrigeration unit on the boat runs on? It runs on the same bunker fuel as moving that boat. I think the days of having our Chinese food delivered is over.
Chinese takeout long distance, that was.
Exactly. So there are, you know, I mean, it's not just about you can't afford to fill your tank and you're going to get off the road, and that's certainly going to happen, and we can talk about that. But the impact of triple-digit oil prices is far more pervasive than that because, you know, if you just go into your Walmart or whatever your big box store is around there, what you'll find is that virtually everything that you buy is made from somewhere else around the world, and it's taken a whole lot of oil to get it to you.
We're talking with Jeff Rubin, an economist who says that your world is about to get a whole lot smaller. His book is called Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, Oil and the End of Globalization. If you'd like to join us and ask him some questions, our local number in the Waterbury area is 244-1777. And our toll-free number is 877-291-8255. Well, Jeff Rubin, we had triple-digit oil last year, as we've been discussing. You found out about peak oil and started extrapolating from that to triple-digit oil back in the year 2000. Tell us how that happened.
Well, you know, I was fortunate to meet some folks, in particular a guy called Colin Campbell, who set up the Association of Peak Oil. He lives in a little village outside of Cork, Ireland, called Ballydehub. And him and a whole bunch of other retired geologists wrote a very convincing case on oil depletion and really opened my eyes to another way of looking at oil supply. If you're a classically trained economist, as I am, you know, you're trained to believe that resource scarcity is basically self-correcting, because the higher prices that come with scarcity bring new supply out of the ground. Well, you know, I mean, that works if the supply physically exists. I guess the theory does work. I mean, we're pulling oil out of places that we've never pulled oil before, like Canadian oil sands, for example, that most people think are the future. But my point is not that we're running out of oil in some absolute geological sense. My point is we're running out of the oil that you can afford to burn. I mean, sure, there's 165 billion barrels of oil, you know, in the Alberta tar sands, but the very world oil prices that you're going to need to make extraction of that resource a 4 to 5 million barrel a day proposition is going to translate into, you know, $7 a gallon gasoline, and that's going to take you right off the road.
Hmm. And when you were senior economist at CIBC World Markets, you appeared on cable TV shows, I believe. I saw some snippets on the internet last year.
That's right. When I was chief economist, I had made in 2005 a prediction that we'd see triple-digit oil prices by 2007. So I guess when that panned out, the next thing you know, I was, you know, on the front page of the Washington Post or the New York Times or CNN or CNBC. But you know, I mean, really, it's not about me. It's a way of understanding the dynamics of supply, because what folk never hear about, you know, they hear press conferences from the Exxons of the world or the Saudi Arabias of the world about this new field discovery and what it's going to be producing. But what you never hear press conferences about is, you know, this field here, it's almost about to be depleted, and it's not going to be producing at all. Hmm. And, you know, you add that up, and that's 4 million barrels a day every year we lose from depletion. Well, over a five-year time period, that means that we've got to find roughly 20 million barrels a day of new production just so that in 2014 we'll be able to consume as much oil as we do in 2009. And what we're losing is the conventional stuff. What we're losing is the stuff that we used to get out of East Texas or light Arab sweet in the Middle East. And what we're replacing it with is stuff 10,000 feet under the floor of the Gulf of Mexico or from oil sand production in Canada and Venezuela. In other words, we're replacing oil that, you know, used to cost $3 a gallon to get out of the ground with oil that's now going to be costing upwards of $100 a gallon to get out of the ground, a barrel to get out of the ground.
Wow. And let's put these numbers in some context, because they're really important numbers for people to understand. Right now, the world produces and consumes about how much oil a day?
Well, before the recession, we were about 86 million barrels a day. So maybe right now we're about 85 with the recession.
Okay.
But, you know, so when I say 5 million barrels a day, I mean, you're basically talking about something like 7% of world production you lose every year. So my point to your listeners is that in this business, all those new discoveries that you hear, that's not additional. That's just replacing. You got to run faster to stand still. And what you're replacing is you're replacing low-cost conventional oil with very high-cost non-conventional oil.
And another way of putting that is extrapolating 5 years ahead, as you did, replacing 20 million barrels per day of production capacity. That's the equivalent of replacing about two Saudi Arabias.
That's right. Or 20 out of 86 is about, you know, a little over 25% of our total production. And, you know, again, there's oil in all kinds of things. I mean, once we run out of sand, there's oil in shale, okay? But what we're doing is we're scraping the bottom of the barrel. Mm. Because in all of these places that we're getting oil out of, whether it's oil sands or whether it's deep water oil or ultimately whether it's shale, what your listeners have to understand is it takes a tremendous amount of energy to get that energy out of the ground. Let me give you an example. Galwar is probably still the largest producing field in the world. It's been running for about 50 years in Saudi Arabia, still home to about 40% of that country's production. For every one British thermal unit, which is a standard unit of energy, for every one BTU of energy invested, you get about 100 back in return. Now go to the Canadian oil sands in Alberta, where the U.S. Department of Energy and the International Energy Agency think is going to be the source of most of the new supply in the next 20 years. For one BTU of energy there, you get three BTUs of energy back. That's the difference.
Pretty small payback on investment.
Scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, Jeff Rubin, you were also the first person that I saw in the mainstream media to talk about what some people have called the export land model, or what you call the cannibalizing of oil exports by oil-producing
Right.
countries. Can you explain how that works?
Well, a couple of years ago, when I was back at chief economist at CIBC World Markets, we put out some research that showed answered a very interesting question. Why is OPEC so thirsty for its own production? And I know that we all like to focus on the growth of demand of oil in places like India and China. And what gets missed on that radar screen is the growth of oil consumption in places like Saudi Arabia, Iran, United Arab Emirates, or Venezuela. And that is as important, if not more important, than depletion in terms of what these countries are going to export to us. And what you will find is that oil consumption growth there is basically the fastest in the world. And the answer is pretty simple. When you fill your tank up in Caracas, you're paying 25 cents a gallon. And in Saudi Arabia, all the hydroelectric power in the Middle East is basically derived from burning oil or natural gas. They don't have any coal. They don't have any hydro. We don't want them to have any nuclear. So they end up burning oil and gas. In Saudi Arabia, the utility pays 3 cents a gallon for the oil that goes up their smokestacks to generate electricity.
And 3 cents a gallon. There are a lot of people who heat their houses in Vermont with oil who'd like to pay 3 cents a gallon for it.
3 cents a gallon. And understand one thing about Saudi. I mean, their huge depletion problem isn't oil, it's water. They've already used 90% of their aquifers. Well, you know, they don't have fresh water, but what they do have is a lot of oil and a lot of salt water. And oil plus salt water equals desalination, which equals fresh water. Next to each desalination plant, there's an oil-burning utility plant that powers that desalination plant that's using 3 cents a gallon oil. Now, at the end of the day, it's their oil. Just like in the Emirates, I mean, they've got an indoor ski hill there where one day carbon turns on the hill is equivalent to burning 3,000 barrels of oil. Now, it's their oil, and they can do whatever they want with it. But the point is, we shouldn't be expecting those countries to be supplying us in the future, because not only is their production peaked, but they're going to be consuming more and more of what they produce. And the more that they consume themselves, the less we're going to get and the higher we're going to pay for what we do get.
And this is not just theoretical. I saw data before the economic downturn hit and demand for oil went down all over. I saw data showing the 20 leading oil exporters were starting to decrease the total amount of oil they were exporting at the same time that the world market prices were hitting record highs.
That's right, because, you know, for the Hugo Chavez's of the world, I mean, everybody criticizes him for not producing enough oil. But, you know, what he gets for one barrel of oil today is 6 to 7 times what he got back in 2000. So he can afford to let his people consume 25 cents a gallon gasoline. And that's his call, just as the Emiratis, I mean, if they want to go skiing when it's, 110 degrees outside and burn 3,000 barrels a day, that's their call, too. But we should just understand that, the days of them exporting 90% of what they produced is long over. And the higher oil prices go, the less they have to export to make the same money.
Well, let's not put too fine an economic point on it. A lot of these countries that subsidize the price of oil have seen unrest, riots break out when they've started to reduce those subsidies. So
that's right.
It's not just a matter of affording to be able to subsidize the oil. Politicians pretty much have to.
The one thing that is common, I mean, OPEC is a very disparate place, separated by history, religion, culture. But the one common denominator is that whether you're in Venezuela, whether you're in Saudi Arabia, whether you're in Iran, people have a God-given right to consume as much cheap oil as they feel like it. And not to be any more sanctimonious, look, I'm from Toronto. We're 90 miles away from Niagara Falls. And people in Toronto have a God-given right to consume as much cheap power as they bloody well feel like it. And anybody who interferes with that gets voted out. So if I live 90 miles away from Gawar, the world's largest oil field, I would probably feel about oil prices the same way I feel about electricity prices living 90 miles away from Niagara Falls. Mm. That's just the way things are.
We're talking with Jeff Rubin. He's the author of Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller. The numbers to join the conversation are locally to Waterbury, 244-1777, or from further afield, toll-free 877-291-8255. Now, Jeff, you write in your book, another way of expressing the end of globalization is to say that high oil prices act in a way which is equivalent to tariffs. Can you explain how that works?
Right. Well, all I'm saying is that when you look at how oil prices impact transport costs, you can express that as a tariff, which is simply an import on taxes. And what you're measuring, a tax on imports. So what you're measuring is how those oil prices affect the final selling price of the good when it's in Walmart or whatever big box store you shop in. And I'm just saying that if you were to express it as a tariff, this is like taking tariff rates to double-digit levels. It's taking tariff rates to the levels that existed in the 1970s and basically reversing all the tariff cuts of the last 30 years. And if you look at the world 30 years ago when we had high tariffs, world trade was a shadow of what it is today. People didn't trade as much. People tended to concentrate on their own domestic markets. And when people did trade, they traded with their regional neighbors. Whereas in the global economy, it's become totally different. It's made producers exporters, and it's made consumers importers. And I think that we're going to go back more to the world of the 70s in the respect that local markets and the domestic market is going to become much more important to businesses than they have in the last three decades of globalization.
And I see the logic in that. Both oil prices and tariffs make it more expensive to import things. But there's a major difference I see between oil prices and tariffs, and that is that tariffs are relatively predictable. Yes, politicians can enact them or repeal them, but it takes some time to do either one of those. So factory owners can plan around them. They can set up a business model based on, you know, where the political winds are blowing, what they might imply for tariffs. But oil prices, I mean, we've seen $147 barrel 1 month, and then 5 months later, $35 barrel oil, and then maybe 8 months after that, we might get $100 barrel oil. How can factory owners in China or the U.S. or Canada plan their future production around such volatile oil prices?
Excellent question. When you're looking at 35 versus 145 in the space of 12 months, I guess the question, and it's the same question to the prospective car buyer, because you know, two Memorial Day weekends ago, gasoline was over $4 a gallon, and this Memorial Day weekend, it was barely over $2. I mean, you buy very different vehicles depending on which gasoline price you're going to be looking at. What's the head fake? Mm. Well, you know, I never said oil prices couldn't decline. Oil prices will decline in recessions, but let's understand one thing. That we've just experienced what we're told by the economists, the deepest recession in the post-war period, not just in the United States, but in the whole oil-consuming world. And, you know, we might have touched 35, but we averaged through that period 40 to 50. Well, 40 to 50 is now where oil trades in the deepest post-war recession. Run the clock back 5 or 6 years ago when those prices were damn close to world record highs. Now it's where oil trades into recession. What does that say? To me, it says that, yeah, we can have affordable oil when we're in a recession and no one can afford to drive. But the minute the recession's over, we're going to see triple-digit oil prices come back. So as far as factories are concerned or as far as car buyers are concerned, unless you plan to run your business for a recession, you better plan on running triple-digit oil prices, because that's where the market's going to be. And it's not that we're going to necessarily go back to local economies because we like local economies or we're making an environmental decision to cut the carbon trail. All of those things are valid. But I'm saying we're going to go back to local economies because we're going to have no choice. That the same economics that moved your factory away to China is bringing your factory back. And, of course, we're going to have to pay more for things. We're not going to have the same infinite variety of consumer choice, and our diets are certainly going to change. But as I say, I think those businesses and manufacturing jobs will come back almost as quickly as they once left.
So I would see a manufacturer having a hard time getting investment capital from, you know, stock offerings right now or bank loans or something like that to put together a production model, a business model based on $100 a barrel oil, because we don't have that now. And I agree with you that we can see that coming in the near future. But how do people go about raising capital when we have, you know, $65, $70 a barrel oil?
Well, it's funny, and again, you know, we say 65, 70 as a depressed price, when, as I point out, 5 years ago would have been an all-time high. But I'll point out the steel example, one of the industries that I looked at initially, and again, this was before the recession hit. This is 2007. Chinese steel exports dropped about 20%. U.S. steel production went up 10%. And all of a sudden, the share prices of U.S. steel went up 100%.
Wow.
Now, had we not had the recession, probably the next act in that play would have been U.S. steelworkers who haven't got a pay raise in probably over a decade going on strike and getting a pay raise. But the fact is that the market very quickly saw the change in the economics of the U.S. steel industry, and the shares of U.S. steel went up 100%. Now, of course, everything got clobbered in the recession subsequently, but I've worked 20 years as an investment, as a chief economist of an investment bank, and believe me, you'll be surprised how quickly capital can make itself available. We'll see those triple-digit oil prices, and all of a sudden, capital will redeploy. you know, the question is going to be, when are we going to see those prices? I think we're going to see those prices 12 months into an economic recovery, and there's growing signs that that recovery probably is starting right around now.
Hmm. We're talking with Jeff Rubin. He's the author of Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, Oil and the End of Globalization. We're about to be joined by Sam Matthews. She's the Executive Vice President of the Central Vermont Economic Development Corporation. And she'll be giving a Vermont perspective on these questions on oil and the end of globalization, what it means for us right here, and whether, you know, to the extent to which she agrees with Jeff Rubin and his thesis. And we'll have time for more of your phone calls. We'll be back with all that right after this.